The author, Colette, once said that she had had a wonderful life, but she wished that she had realized it earlier. And there's a certain kind of wry humor in that, because of the fact that there is this tendency for us to overlook what we do have in favor of what we think we want. And seeing what it is that we had, if at all, in retrospect. And that tendency to see that we had missed the opportunity to register our sense of abundance or good fortune leads to a sense of sadness. The practice of mudita has opened in many ways in my life, but one of the things that has opened my heart to is to be able to receive the love of my mother, who is now gone. She died a number of years ago. And it really was through the practice of mudita that the capacity to receive that which is she was always trying to give me, finally was matured. It's not that I idealized that she was this perfect being, and that I was this crippled being unable to receive. It was just all in the kind of karmic confusion that existed between us. But what's become clear since then is that the motivation was deep. The love was pure and it was constant, even though it got distorted. But the distortion has fallen away. And suddenly, with this deep appreciation, I finally know in my 60s that I was truly loved. Mudita uncovers the truth of our abundance. It's the third of the Brahma Viharas. And another term for a Brahma Vihara is apamana, which is illimitable. And this refers to the fact that it has no boundaries, that there is no limit to it, and that therefore its nature is all-inclusive. So when I engage a Brahma Vihara, in this case mudita, I give the power to the knowing that it's only through the cultivation of the mudita that I will ever be able to see clearly the extraordinary good fortune of this life. And that sense of good fortune, as a number of people have mentioned, at first take is just that sense of the material. One hears about appreciative joy, and one assesses joy based on one's experience of joy or the limited experience of it, or for some more. But this is a kind of gladness of the heart that isn't related to laughter or merriment, as it said, but a broad and wide and deep expanse of receptivity that has a certain feeling tone that allows for clarity of perception. And as I mentioned this morning, this clarity perception that arises out of the healing, let's say, of that view of insufficiency. I think we can all identify with that sense of the separate self that views that which isn't. And oftentimes, the underlying insidious forces associated with the lack of mudita are covered by, for instance, the function or the process of criticism. Criticism is actually oftentimes an expression of jealousy. Jealousy, an expression of insufficiency. It's a constriction born of that sense of not having. There's an image that you may have already heard about, perhaps many times, of what's referred to as the hungry ghost. And the hungry ghost is a creature, a being, with an enormous belly and a tiny little mouth, as tiny as a mouth can be. And so its entire existence is kind of sniffing around and sucking and sucking and drawing in from and taking in, but nothing satisfies it. And to some degree, that's the lack of mudita, just that sense of the shame associated with this ongoing sense and this painful sense of insufficiency and the sense of neediness in it. And how well we cover that neediness. Because, in fact, if we open to it fully, without balance, it would be completely overwhelming. The truth is that we are hungry through our eyes, and we are hungry through our ears, and we are hungry through our olfactory experience of the world. We are hungry through our mouths. We are hungry through the tactile relationship through life. And we wish to draw in, and we want that which we actually push away. And that's the strangeness of the lack of mudita. We create a separation from that which is wanted, is needed. It's a very sad thing, and we all experience a sadness. It's helpful to know that what's referred to as the near enemy to mudita, or perhaps that quality that masquerades as mudita, is exuberance. It's that sense of frenetic joy. That excited, I can't breathe so much, I'm finally getting what it is that I want or need, and it's a kind of a nervous experience. And it's actually considered a form of suffering because it holds within its conditioning a form of aversion. Whereas mudita is broad and smooth. It's a quality of joy that leads to expansiveness. There's a particular reference in the Bible, and whenever I refer to the Bible, I also need to apologize that I actually know very little about the Bible, but there are these exquisite poetic moments that I've had in hearing the wisdom of the Bible. And there's this reference to fit to receive. And when I first heard that, it sort of marked for myself a sense that it represented the end of a karma associated with the belief that I had that I was not worthy of receiving. And in that lack of worthiness, there was just a lack of receptivity. I remember one time I was leaving someplace with a friend, and my friend had observed a certain interaction between myself and someone else who was trying to say thank you for something. And my friend said, "Do you realize that you deflected that experience, that you didn't allow yourself to receive that person's gratitude?" And I stopped, and I realized, oh my goodness, that isn't that true? Another little kind of message about this karma turning towards a receptivity, because I was able to receive that information and become much more intentionally open to the gifts that others had to offer me. And I began to feel actually overwhelmed at generosity and kindness and kind of positive reflections from life and from the world, not at all what it is that my inner self had sort of built up as its self-perception. So there's a quality within the cultivation of mudita that helps to ripen that shift that towards the capacity to receive. The capacity to receive at the material level, but also at the more subtle spiritual level. Mudita has helped me to open to the extraordinary gratitude that I have for the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha. Just sometimes it's almost at a level of kind of an ecstatic sense of, oh my goodness, how could this happen in this life? That this being, this child, this young woman had this extraordinary good fortune of hearing of the Dhamma. It said the greatest good fortune is to hear of the Dhamma, and that doesn't necessarily mean literally hear. It can arise through any of the six sense doors. It can be to read, you know, to hear, to perceive in some way, for the mind to open to the Dhamma, to that inherent sense of lawfulness that governs the mind and body, and that sense of unity of being and faith that exists within that discovery, that kind of complete transformation that occurs in that moment, even though it isn't ripened, that hearing of the Dhamma, as it said. And then, yet there's a greater good fortune, actually, that as a result of the hearing of the Dhamma, that it's the opportunity to practice the Dhamma, that this is even a greater good fortune, because how can we practice that which we haven't heard about? And so this ongoing sense of the receptivity to the teachings that nourish, referred to as a form of, as a nutrient that nourish the heart, that reveal the way. And for us to intuitively practice the way, and to be in this perpetual process of being nourished and practicing and expressing this even greater good fortune of not only hearing about the Dhamma, but to practice the Dhamma. And then even greater good fortune, see, it just keeps opening up like a flower, is the realization of Dhamma. And with mudita, it's clear that something isn't an absolute. It's a process. Nothing is an absolute. It's a process. So realization is not an absolute, although realization can take a form of completion, fruition, but that it's an actual process. The process of realizing the Dhamma is essentially moment to moment when the conditions are well established within the mind. That quality of mudita, receptivity, that capacity to receive, to take in, to perceive accordingly, to perceive through the mind of mudita is therefore to process that is which is perceived. And this is one of the important correlations that we may wish to keep in mind, that without mindfulness, in this case, the cultivation of mudita, there just isn't the capacity to open to that depth of gratitude that allows for us to receive in a way that shifts our perception so that we actually are therefore able to process according to this particular awakened quality. So, to speak, just as was mentioned with mindfulness and with metta and with karuna, that's to say that we don't really see ourselves, we don't see ourselves and therefore the other. We don't see the process of self and therefore the process of other. We don't see ourselves, other, this world, this universe, clearly. And one reason that we do not see or perceive or process all of this clearly is because the nature of mind in its receptivity hasn't completely establish that receptivity, that receiving, just the receiving, the ongoing nutrient of the unfolding process of life. So when one hears of appreciative joy, that ability to appreciate, it's also synonymous, kindred to that ability to receive, the capacity to receive. As well, mudita, in all that I've mentioned, is a medicine, a purifying medicine. This is another practice that is referred to as a purifying practice. And it's the medicine for jealousy and envy. The Buddha often referred to himself as a doctor. And it's an interesting way of viewing the power of the Buddha's presence as a doctor. And therefore the teachings, and in this case, mudita, were considered to be medicines. And that therefore it's said that the practitioner is the nurse administering the medicine, that we're taking this medicine of mudita. And it's like other medicines that miraculously address or isolate certain factors and help to relieve distress and disease, you know, in the medical world of medicine, in the herbal world of medicine, so forth. This is a mind-liberating medicine. For as we cultivate the mudita, then we begin to receive this medicine that then permeates our minds and bodies and counteracts the existence of jealousy and envy and resentment. And sometimes there's also a reference to disgust, which is kind of a raw reference, disgust. Jealousy is the pain, a very insidious, pernicious, and vicious experience of pain, an expression of that hunger ghost that just, you know, perpetual sense of not having. Its constrictive nature is painful, like a cramp. And so therefore, when the mind is in the perception of insufficiency, then when it sees that which it believes it does not have, then there's this deep, visceral, and mental and heartfelt pain. But because of the fact that mudita is not yet awakened, is one of the dark and aberrant and unwholesome and can't think of the other word, afflictive experiences that we are not conscious of. Before it's felt, it arises in the form of jealousy and envy, and it therefore expresses itself in that way. And as I mentioned, one of the manifestations of that is that of resentment. It's like, you know that one? It's like, you know, on the surface. And it's like that pretense, you know, so wonderful to see you. You know, inside. And just that self-consciousness that leads to portrayal, you know, and the portrayal becomes this kind of, actually takes on its own body, So consciousness actually takes on its own body, and it's the body of pretense, and it's a very, very well-designed body. You will never, ever see jealousy in my eyes. No, no. I know how to cover it. There's a quote that comes to mind that I generally remember associated more with compassion, but still, you know, compassion for the lack of mudita. It's a line from a Emily Dickinson poem, and it goes that there is a pain so utter that we cover the abyss with trance. And that sense of this pain that is so utter that we just push it away, and then we have adaptive behavior. And it's a very, very, very confusing process that we take on. So that we tend to convey the opposite of what our experience is. Very, very difficult to realize that in that there is no authentic being, there is no breath. Very likely there is no breath. There certainly is no conscious breath. Because in this underlying state of anguish and deprivation, everything is withdrawn. And there can be a huge gap between the actuality of one's underlying experience and that constructed portrayal. One reference for it is personality. I had a very interesting experience. I know a very devout yogi, very devout, and have known this yogi for many years, and have watched this individual choose the Dhamma moment by moment and extraordinarily even unconscionable experiences in the face of unconscionable forms of the vicissitudes. And and it was very interesting because after all of that and all of this, there was a moment where this individual realized, the one thing I cannot give up is my personality. It's just too effective. It gets me what I want. This person just happened to have a very good personality. I remember, this is ancient times, when I was in high school. You know, it was like people were talked about in terms of their personality. This person has a good personality. This person doesn't have a... And I thought, oh, what's that personality? I better get going with this thing. I want one of these good things called personalities. I don't know if I ever really developed one very effectively, but I do see traces of it in moments in which it's just not possible to be honest with myself because of some other overriding conditioning. The lack of mudita is also associated with our tendency to create a sense of territory. This is mine, that's yours. And you better not assume any kind of ownership over this. Because if you do, I have these energies called kilesas, hindrances, greed, ill will, and delusion, and I am going to arm myself with them, and I am going to defend myself and what belongs to me. And this is called war. But it's not just in terms of the kind of vast, unbelievable, dark ugliness that occurs within the literal form that war is taking. You know, that's mine. No, it's mine. You know, I have spiritual ownership over this. No, no, I do. You know, religious war, my goodness. You know, in the name of God, oh my goodness. I mean, what greater rationale does one have to fight a war than in the name of the Almighty? But really, the underlying cause is the lack of mudita. The lack of mudita that allows for the forces of jealousy and envy and resentment and disgust, allow that one, to just kind of spin out into its infinite force of reactivity. Again, reinforced by the rationales born of the mistaken view of my and mine, the separate sense of self, all the information that organizes around that particular view. And then, naturally, there's conflict. This conflict exists in every family. Well, this conflict is likely to exist within the family. It takes the form of these little minute power struggles, you know. It's sort of like this waging of war within. And it's a kind of interesting thing. It can just be a one-upsmanship. Within that domain of family, it's interesting that the exemplar for mudita exists, which is the mother or of child relationship, or the parent-child, but specifically mother-child. And it's that experience of the child becoming an individual, beginning to become independent, no longer a part of this mother body, no longer held within kind of the sweetness of the metta, no longer under one's control, no longer something that can be shaped, you know, no longer something that is a mirror of how one wishes the being to be. The child is, you know, expressing its own nature, and it's creative, and it's connecting with others and forming relationships, you know, with the world. And it is not unusual for the unconscious force of jealousy and envy to arise within the relationship between the mother, parent, child. And it's said that if there is jealousy in relationship with the child, then the child responds by forming guilt. And that's just a kind of karmic term in the nature. And so oftentimes it's just extraordinary how that jealousy leads to a deprivation, specifically when the, not this good mother with good intentions, but when the hindrances arise and that sense of fear of the child being out of one's control arises, and it moves into a state of deprivation and depriving that child of joy. And recently, a Dhamma friend told me about her childhood and how her mother used to tell her things like, you know, I don't think those people really want you to call them. I don't think they're interested in hearing from you. There was something that cut away at every social instant within this young child's mind. Oh, you know, when these people come, I don't think that you should bother them. It was a very kind of thorough and insidious attack at the social instincts of this being, and until the being just did fall into a state of isolation and deep loneliness, because every movement towards connecting was undermined very thoroughly, very methodically. And then the pattern went on that the expression, once that had been accomplished, then the next stage of the conditioning was to ignore any kind of, you know, creative thinking or whatever. Just ignore this person. and continue through adulthood. Now, that sounds terrible, but it's not terribly unusual. It really isn't. It's unconscious. It happens unconsciously. That resentment of the one that we love most, because guess what? They're separate from us, and that separate sense of self moves into a state of resentment of that. And oftentimes it can take very, very hateful forms. I have a story that many of you have heard over and over again, but it just is my mudita story. And it's the story of a birthday party for my daughter. It just was such a clear moment for me of choice. And so at this birthday party, friends were invited to make something and to bring something they had made, created, rather than buying something. Isn't that a nice idea? You know, don't we like that? Isn't that wholesome? And so everybody, you know, brought a little kind of makeshift gift. You know, these are kids who are probably around 5, 6 years old. And so there was a point at which my daughter came running to me with this complete gladness of heart and joy and said, "Look, Mommy." And I looked, and it was like this little piece of paper, kind of cut like that, with this piece of, I think it was red yarn hanging from it. You know, kind of one of those fat, fluffy pieces of yarn kind of hanging from it. And I went, and it was so shocking, because it was like, you know, that revulsion came up. It was like, and then fear came up. And it was like, I just don't know what to say, you know? And then that sense, and it was, you know, this is a little bit of dramatization of it, but the fear had to do with the fact that I did not want to confirm my daughter's gladness. Because what if this is all she expected in life? You know, a little crumpled piece of paper cut at angles, you know, with this red fluffy yarn hanging on it. And it was like, I can't confirm this. You know, that's terrible. I didn't do it. You know, I used mudita. I didn't have resources in that moment to meet the moment, to meet the situation in an intentional way. And I'm looking at my daughter and she's gushing, you know, and I'm going, turning into a demon. And then I go, oh, may this good fortune continue and increase. And the shift happened into a kind of communion with the gladness. It wasn't about the object. It wasn't about the fear. It wasn't about the resentment of that potential in that moment. I mean, what kind of gift is that? You know, whatever. It wasn't about any of that. It was just that moment of connecting with things as they are. And it was so vivid in terms of how it kind of reverberated. And that's one way that the practice of mudita works. It is a mind-liberating practice, and therefore, in the concentrated mind of mudita, I'd like to clarify something here. There are two ways that mudita or any other wholesome quality arises, and that is either spontaneously, because of its prior cultivation, or intentionally. And we sort of wait to expect it to happen, you know, spontaneously. But those are the two possibilities. So in this experience of mudita, there is the increasing clarity when it is not present. And the increasing efficiency by which one registers this and is able to respond rather than to react. And all of this can just be absolutely in a flash. That moment that I dramatized happened in a flash. It wasn't an hour. It was just in a mere moment. But when something is concentrated, when the mind is concentrated, there is this efficiency of recognition. And that which is recognized is either the wholesome quality arising, which can then be the response, and one can join it and continue to cultivate it, or the revelation of the unwholesome, in which case, in a state of relative concentration or degrees of concentration, that efficiency of shifting from the unwholesome to the wholesome potential happens just in a split second. And there are references to mind moments being broken down in units of time that we do not even have references for yet in science, in the Buddhist cosmology. So all of this can just happen so quickly. And there's such a sense of gratitude that arises when the wholesomeness of mind prevails. There's something very reassuring just about wholesomeness and unwholesomeness. One of the reasons that we cultivate mindfulness and mudita is in order to cultivate that which is wholesome, because in the physics of practice, that which is wholesome will predominate over that which is not. This is a good thing to remember, you know, when we're just sitting there in the desert of our practice and, you know, there's nothing. And, you know, what we want is everything. And there's nothing. And all there is just the opportunity to continue to cultivate mindfulness, to continue to cultivate mudita. Oh, where's this joy? You know, where's this promised land? You know, where's this garden? Where are the flowers? The Buddha said that a mind of mudita is very rare. In fact, it might be the rarest wholesome mind state. And it's very, very interesting to me in light of the light scholarly inclinations that I have in this life. And when I say light scholarly, I actually only develop a scholarly interest to the degree that I can communicate with real scholars. real scholars like Andy Olinsky or Thomas Arabiku or Bhikkhu Bodhi, you know, just to know enough about the language of Pali and such to be able to do inquiry at that level. And I was recently sitting with Venerable Sai Dhamma Vivekananda. And there's a mystery before I actually go on to that, in that it became clear to me in the research that I did that mudita is hardly ever mentioned in the suttas. It's mentioned as one of the four Brahma Viharas. I have twins. They're mine. even though they're 23 years old, they still belong to me. Anyway, when they were still impressionable, I said to them one day, "Hey, come with me, because let's go do some research in the Buddhist library on mudita." I can't believe it that they actually said okay. That's a cause for mudita, isn't it? And so I set them to work. You know, I said, "Okay, here's a bunch of books. I can't believe it." And I said, "All right, now I had my son Joshua go through the Dhammapada, and then I had my daughter go through another text." You know, and it was like, "Okay, this is the word you're looking for." And they did it all afternoon long, and they actually came up with the results, and you know, told me where that word was and so forth. And anyway, it was very sweet. That will never happen again. It never did, nor will it ever. It might, actually, with my daughter. But anyway, so hardly a reference. Again, only just a kind of reference without any kind of information. So I begin to think how strange this is. And I begin to correlate. Is it possible that it simply has never, within the history of this era of mankind, meaning this Buddha era, beginning 2,600 years ago, has simply never been cultivated? Is it possible? Do I know anybody who's ever cultivated it? No. I mean, a little bit, you know, but really, really taken on the commitment to awaken it? No. Okay. So, you know, this began to kind of make sense because as I became more attuned to the mudita through deciding, therefore, that I would be at least one who did to some degree, you know, awaken this particular quality in order to know it and to be able to perceive the world accordingly, began to see that the world was bereft of it. So anyway, there was an interesting moment where I was sitting in retreat. We were sitting in retreat with Venerable Ajahn Vivekananda, this very astute scholar. I mean, I think he thinks in Pali amongst other seven languages or other six languages. And he was giving this Dhamma talk and he was just kind of casually said, yeah, you know, all the Brahma-viharas other than mudita arise naturally within the practice of Vipassana. And it was like, oh, there it is again. So he was a very nice man and very approachable. And so at the end of the retreat, he and I just had some casual time together in conversation. And I said, you know, Venerable Sayadaw Vivekananda, I said, pardon me, but intuitively I just can't agree with you that mudita doesn't arise spontaneously in Vipassana because it is a wholesome quality. And everything a wholesome arises naturally as a result of a cultivation of mindfulness. Isn't that true? And he went, oh. You know, it wasn't like we were vying to find out what was the truth. It was just, you know, could that be? So he said, okay, well, when I go back to India, I have a text that's in Burmese that's never been translated, and I'll look into the text and see, you know, if I can find anything. And we haven't had an exchange about it since then. But I just find it extraordinarily mysterious that this particular powerful quality, which is the means to purify the suffering associated with greed and ill will and resentment and disgust, has no commentary. And so one of the wonderful things about being in a position where I can offer reflections on mudita and instructions for the cultivation of mudita is that occasionally when another mind goes, hey, yeah, you know, I want to do that, then there it begins, a dialogue. What have you discovered? What is the result of this concentrated mind of mudita? What is the perception? How does this mind of conditioned by mudita perceive and process the world? And then, guess what? There's commentary. I love that it is up to us to cultivate the Dhamma. It just remains dormant. Otherwise, it remains dormant within the individual, it remains dormant within the family, it remains dormant within the workplace, it remains dormant within the culture. It remains dormant within the so forth and so on world, planet, universe. I don't know about universe, but, you know, it remains dormant. It's said that when one, somebody said that when one drinks deeply from the cultivation of mudita, then one is able, therefore, to as well share that quality that exists within another, even if one does not, isn't aware of it. And what better way to reinforce it than to be aware of it, to share joy, to share gladness, to share happiness, to share that moment of good fortune that exists, even if it's a split second. My son recently was married. He had a marriage ceremony. And one of the greatest mudita experiences I ever had in my life was that he asked me to officiate. And I thought, oh my, what? You know, me? Your mother? The one who's the only problem you have in life? You know, it's like the root of all evil, you know? The basis of all the problems you have in your life? Me? Anyway. And then she did as well. She asked, you know, would you officiate our ceremony? And I went, oh my goodness, yes. And there was just this amazing sense of light and joy in that experience of these two human beings who I happen to know to some degree, not really well, not yet, coming together. It was a mudita experience. That I knew it was a mudita experience. And that was the essence of the gift that I had to give, although they don't know this, is that although there was the officiation and the agreed upon process, what I agreed to do was to cultivate with myself, was to cultivate mudita throughout the entire event. And I don't know, you know, whether it was my illusion or not, but it was, for everyone, such an extraordinarily joyful experience. And I understand weddings can be joyful and they're fun and so forth, but there was something in the air. And it just kept evolving and opening and opening and opening. It was a truly blessed event. And that reminds me of something that represents the lack of mudita, which is this little cartoon that somebody gave me. Are they called cartoons? You know, they're in little, these little pictures and little, is that a cartoon? Yeah, so, and it's the images of a bride in her regalia and her white and flowing, and the groom in tuxedo, and they're sitting at one of those the tables that caterers bring with them with a tablecloth over it, but you fold it up and take it away. And there's an older woman sitting there, and I'm assuming she's an aunt, although it didn't say that she was. And the caption is her voice saying, and how long is it that you plan to remain married? And that to me is the verbal kind of version of another aspect of the lack of mudita, which is the derisive mind, or derisive, which is the elbow that goes. It's the elbow, you know. It's that gesture that says, yeah. And then there's some undermining comment. Oh, and it feels so good. You know, it's like that agreement to undermine the experience. Oh, well, she's not really so, or he's not, or they really know. It's like that undercurrent, that derisive tendency. And more than the actual jealousy and envy and other, including disgust, I feel that that kind of kinesthetic of, is there somebody I can do this with? You know, that just that sense of, I just don't want this person to be happy. You know, I'm sorry, you know, I just would rather that you suffer. You know, I just don't want you to have this abundance. This, I'm playing it out, right? But that sensation that moves through the mind in the form of thought, that sensation that then takes the form of speech, and then as well that sensation that has a physical expression. These are the three karmas. Thought, speech, and physical action or deeds. And it's very important for us to cultivate that which allows for the objective consciousness, which allows for the capacity to register that which arises through these three karmas, in order to really allow for mindfulness into that process, so as to usurp the conditioned tendencies towards that kind of suffering, the perpetuation of the suffering that arises out of jealousy and envy and resentment. Ah, such a cold, cold state of being. So disconnected. So, I'll end with the image that's given for mudita. It's the image of a flower in full bloom. And I always think of my mother at this moment. My mother, my first sangha was Japanese, and my mother spoke fluent Japanese. And we were standing at a window in her home, and she was in a state of reverie, and I was just kind of looking at her, because this was not someone who went into a state of reverie very often. It was like, and I went and stood next to her, and I kind of was looking at, what is she looking at? And she was looking at this bush that had flowered, that she had planted many years before. And she was looking at the flowers, and she just uttered this word. She said, Monkai. And I looked, and she said, full bloom. And I looked, and there was that sense of yes, this is mudita. It's that joy that we experience in the beauty of something, at that perfection, that state. And the lack of mudita is that withdrawing attention from that because of the preoccupation with the fact that it's not going to last. It's going to wither. I can't take this in. So mudita allows for us to experience those moments of monkai, of full bloom. And oftentimes they are just moments. But in the stillness of the mind, there is a receptivity to that beauty that translates it into something deep and pervasive and nourishing. So perhaps you would like to join me for a few moments of mudita bhavana, the cultivation of mudita, appreciative joy. And perhaps just that sense of dedicating one's unconscious that which is unconsciously rooted in jealousy and envy, just kind of dedicating this practice to the willingness to allow for these sources of suffering to be uprooted for the sake of oneself and all beings. And from this place of dedication, continue with the mudita practice. May you, may we enhance our lives with the cultivation of mudita. May my good fortune continue and increase. May your good fortune continue and increase. May our good fortune continue and increase. May that quality of mudita awaken within all beings. May all beings' good fortune continue and increase. Surrendering one's jealousy and envy to the Dhamma. May my good fortune continue and increase. I'm very grateful for the efforts that you have made in the practice today.